Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. You may have heard about the partnership between WBUR and the New York Times, Modern Love, the podcast. Well, the podcast debuts today, and in a moment, we will listen to one of the two episodes being released today. But first, we have Dan Jones joining us from a studio in Amherst. Dan is the editor and creator of the New York Times column, Modern Love. Dan, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here with you.
So what was your reaction when you first thought of this idea about turning Modern Love into an audio podcast?
Well, I think these stories are pretty rich sometimes, rich with experience and emotion. And I'm always curious to see what more can be done with them. And when WBUR came up with this idea of having them be, these audio versions and soundscaped, as they described it, with music and sort of subtle sound effects, and I was totally intrigued. I thought, why not? It sounds like a great idea.
What changes for you, do you think, when a written essay is now going into audio form?
Well, I think some stories adapt better to audio than others. And when we were deciding on what stories we would start with and have these actors consider, stories that are more dramatic, that have a dramatic arc, that have dialogue and action, we thought would be better than stories that were more about ideas or that sort of thing. But to tell you the truth, I've been pleasantly surprised to see a couple of the more powerful ones that we've recorded so far do not follow that pattern. They are internal, very internal and emotional and sort of an internal dialogue kind of thing, like the one that Jason Alexander reads. And so it really depends a lot on how much the actor can bring to it and how much emotion they can bring to it. But God, these have really been powerful for me to hear.
Why do you think that Modern Love has resonated with so many people?
it's hard for me to say. I feel very invested in these lives, and so much material comes in compared to what gets published in the column. We get about 7,000 submissions a year and publish 52. So that turns out to be about one out of every 150. And to tell you the truth, the pieces that wind up in the column really do rise from that that sort of mass of submissions. They're incredibly vulnerable at times. There are people who have been through hard things and are trying to examine it. And I think it has the appeal of, someone sitting across from you in a coffee shop telling you about some sort of problem that they've been going through. It's that intimate. And to have that kind of intimacy in a paper that's read by millions of people, there's some sort of special charge associated with that, or there must be, because it has really caught on and it seems to be more popular each year.
Okay. Well, Dan Jones is the editor and creator of the New York Times column Modern Love. His most recent book is titled Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. He joined us from Armadillo Audio Group in Amherst, Massachusetts. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now let's hear the much-anticipated episode One Last Swirl, written by New York Times columnist Dan Barry and read by former Seinfeld actor Jason Alexander.
My daughter's stupid fish is dying. She is coping with the news by making the necessary arrangements for a burial at sea via a flush toilet. To her, death is an unformed concept. She is 5 3/4 years old. I, though, am unnerved by the fish's approaching demise. I gaze into the clear, round bowl, hoping for another performance of its darting dance of life. Instead, I see only a creature as still as the ceramic mermaid it leans against, save for tiny gills that seem to be gasping. This is crazy, I know. The fish is well more than 3 years old and cost about $3 at the local pet store. It is the size and color of a Dorito. In the unnatural, natural order of things, its kind are like disposable toys. We humans usually consider fish like this to be eminently flushable. I'm just not up to it. For the record, I am a fish person only in the sense that I like to eat them. Then why have I become emotionally attached to a pocket-sized creature that lives in a cocoon of water? It does not sleep in my lap. We do not play fetch. Never once have I taken it for a walk, or even a swim. A satisfactory answer evades me. But in its BB-sized eyes I see, or I think I see, the panic before acceptance. I've seen that before in other eyes, and never mind. Just know that I have become a caregiver to a $3 fish that could fit in my mouth. Every day now, I shake out 7 or 8 pellets and carefully fling them into the bowl, one by one, aiming the brown specks so they descend where the fish can eat them with minimal movement. Sometimes they float just beyond his mouth and he bites and misses. But there's little I can do. More than water separates us. "Come on, eat something, please," I say, until I remember that I am pleading with a fish. Then come flashbacks of having said these very words before, with similar emphasis. Only they were associated with cans of Ensure, chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla, bought by the case years ago in the deluded belief that they could magically protect a loved one against cancer. "Come on, eat something, please. Your body needs to be strong." All those cans of Ensure poured down the drain or thrown out unopened by the six-pack, by the case. Too painful to even keep in the house once their purpose had passed. Now about this stupid fish. It is known formally as John Cronin the Fish, and it goes way back in my young family. When my older daughter, Nora, got a tropical fish several years ago, my younger daughter, Grace, became mesmerized by the swimming, the swirling, the very being of such a wondrous thing. After studying it with focused intensity, Grace finally announced that she could not go on living the beginning of her days without a fish of her own. My wife, Mary, and I tried to impress upon her the many responsibilities of fish ownership, feeding the fish, cleaning the fish's bowl, feeding the fish, cleaning the fish's bowl, feeding the fish, cleaning the fish's bowl. But Grace was 2 at the time and besotted. If we had said she would have to carry the fish to the ocean every week so that it could confer with Poseidon, she would have said, "Yes, yes, yes, please, I want a fish, please, yes." Which is what we finally said after being shamed by Nora's sweet offer to use half her life savings, about $6, to buy a fish for her little sister. The family went to the pet store, spent more on the glass bowl than on its tenant, and covered the base of its new home with small phosphorescent rocks that looked like children's breakfast cereal. We then tucked that little mermaid upright into this Fruity Pebbles beach, but she kept listening to the side as though woozy from one too many Mai Tais at some figurine mixer. A morning ritual began. My wife made the coffee, let the dog out, gently roused the girls, and did pretty much everything else that makes morning so glorious an entrance into another day. My role simply was to choose some ill-timed moment, say the last-minute school bus scramble, to call out, "Did anyone feed John Cronin the fish?" Over the years, the fish demonstrated a will to live so strong that I could not shake the old Monty Python, "I'm not dead yet," routine from my twisted mind. Just one example. In carefully preparing for a 2-week vacation last summer, we corralled a relative to feed John Cronin the fish the first week, and a neighbor to feed him the second week. But in the end, it was as though these conversations had been conducted at the town pool underwater, because John Cronin the fish wasn't fed for nearly 2 weeks. When we returned, we tried to ease our guilt by sending a plentiful rain of pellets cascading down around him. He accepted the food and did a twirl or two as if to say, "That's life." That is life. Though for the last few weeks, John Cronin the fish has not been enjoying it Every morning now, I tap on the bowl in small applause, hoping this might initiate that affirming underwater ballet. But he remains still, his bowl's glass magnifying the whisper of his gills. All I can do is reach again for the small cardboard cylinder of fish food. As these brown bits of sustenance pause on water's surface, then begin their dreamlike descent to those fruity pebble rocks, I think of the sugary tea and cinnamon toast that my mother, 10 years gone, would serve me when I stayed home from school, partly sick, partly seeking reassurance that she would always, always be there when I needed her. Kids think like that. Many years later, I tried to repay the favor when my mother became wholly sick, not partly sick. "Have a sip of tea," I would say. "Have a bite of toast. Have some Ensure. Chocolate, strawberry, vanilla." But she would not. She would smile, shake her head, and look away with a gaze that was past panic. She was 61. I look now at the food pellets gathered around the fish, my face nearly pressed against the glass of the bowl. "Eat," I say sharply. My wife calls from the kitchen. "Is everything all right up there?" "Everything's fine," I call back, not wanting to get into it. And then back to the fish. "You stupid fish," I hiss. "Eat." It was the same with my father last year at the veterans home. At his bedside, measuring the inhalations, hoping against the evidence that he would rouse and ask for a roast beef sandwich on rye with brown mustard, a piece of Enderman's cake, a good cup of coffee, a glass of water. Just water would have delighted me. His appetite was considerable once. On Thanksgiving, my father would delight in the tray of olives and celery presented by my mother. He had a deliberate way of sprinkling salt on the stalk, then onto the turkey and stuffing and candied yams and potatoes and string beans and pie and more pie. "A sip of water, Dad. Just a sip." I, too, have watched from the other side of the glass. In a hospital bed and in my own bed, so sick from surgery and chemotherapy and radiation that the very thought of a stalk of celery or a sprinkling of salt would make me gag. And here would come my wife, setting down a tray of tea and toast, gently encouraging me to eat because she didn't know what else to say, other than that she loves me, just as I had said to my mother and father. Now this stupid fish, contained in its own universe, yet part of mine, sharing space on my 5-year-old daughter's dresser with a few stray playing cards, some mismatched socks, and a magnetic music box. You wind it up, and 2 ladybug figurines spin and skate upon a green pond, all to the theme song from Love Story. I wind up the box to hear the music. How does it go again? "Where do I begin? To tell the story of how great a love can be." Officially, I detest this theme from Love Story, but right now, it doesn't seem so bad, as 2 inanimate bugs made of wood and magnets come to life. All the while, John Cronin the fish remains as still as ceramic. Stupid fish. Stupid, beautiful fish.
To listen to the weekly Modern Love podcast, subscribe to Modern Love on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Full versions of the podcast will include conversations with the authors of the essays and the host of the Modern Love podcast, Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Imogene Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Brusek. We had help today from Virginia Marshall and special help this week from Mike Garth. Our technical director is Tim Skog. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.